This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Spotlight on the Middle East, as we focus on U.S.-Saudi ties, the politics of the World Cup, Iran and Israel. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi government agents in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018 cast a pall over relations between Washington and Riyadh. It was an operation that the U.S. intelligence community believe was ordered by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. So when the Biden administration recently ruled that the Crown Prince, known as MBS, has immunity from a lawsuit over the murder of Khashoggi, it came under intense criticism. Earlier in October, the OPEC Plus oil producer group led by Saudi Arabia cut oil production, raising the specter of higher gasoline prices, which rankled Washington, coming as it did over U.S. objections and before the midterm elections. The move to reduce the global oil supply also upset Europe, which plans to reduce its dependency on Russian gas and other sources of energy. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in Doha this week that, quote, the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia is under review, and underscored that the opinion on immunity for MBS, who has the legal status of head of state, does not speak to the merits of the case, nor the status of the bilateral relationship, unquote. Secretary Blinken was in Doha for an annual U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue, but as an avowed soccer fan, he also took the opportunity to cheer the U.S. team in its World Cup match against Wales. Qatar, the first Middle Eastern country to host the global sporting event, has faced criticism for endangering the lives of hundreds of thousands of laborers from poor South Asian countries who built most of the stadiums. Analysts say that Qatar is emerging as one of Washington's most valuable partners in the region, despite its treatment of migrant workers and the LGBTQ community. In Iran, women-led protests, which erupted in September after the death of Mahsa Amini, who was arrested for improperly covering her head, have morphed into broad nationwide anti-regime demonstrations. The Islamic regime has engaged in a violent crackdown on civilians, which has led to more than 15,000 arrests and hundreds of deaths. In Israel, Bibi is back. A coalition led by the right-wing former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu won a majority of seats in the parliament or Knesset in the November election, allowing the provocative politician, who is on trial for corruption, to form a government with some of the most ultranationalist and racist elements in Israeli politics today. For more on these issues, we turn to two distinguished Middle East experts. Ellen Lapson is professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. That's a college based in the nearby state of Virginia. Previously, she held senior national security positions in the U.S. government. And Hussein Ibish, he is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He is also a weekly columnist for Bloomberg and The National. And both guests join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Carol. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Let me begin with you, Ellen Lapson. We'll start with U.S.-Saudi relations. President Biden said that he would treat Saudi Arabia differently than his predecessor. He would treat it as a pariah state, especially, you know, after the intelligence community deemed that MBS was behind Khashoggi's murder. President Biden went there in July. He asked Riyadh to release more oil due to Russia's war, and he was snubbed. Now, is there any merit, in your view, to the criticism of the Biden administration? And why, after saying he would not deal in the same way with Saudi Arabia as his predecessors, do you think Biden condoned the ruling of immunity for MBS regarding Khashoggi's murder?
So I think the Democratic Party has been seeking a kind of recalibration of the U.S.-Saudi relationship for quite a while. And the emergence of MBS as a very powerful new generation leader who is perhaps less attentive to some of the protocols of the past in the U.S.-Saudi relationship has really produced some awkward moments for U.S. policy. My own view is that President Biden may have gone out on a limb a little bit too far in sort of having a human rights-driven driven as opposed to pragmatic driven policy towards Saudi Arabia. And now what we're seeing is these awkward steps backward to try to get back on a more productive keel. There is still a demand, particularly from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, to make human rights and internal governance issues more prominent and to say that while the U.S. and Saudi Arabia may share interests, they don't necessarily share values. So it's a problematic relationship. Then you add the oil decisions on top of it, and it's really been a rocky road for this administration. I don't think that this renewed commitment to we're going to revisit the relationship and decide what we want to get out of this relationship is going to be successful. I think they will have to revert back to a more realist position about the U.S.-Saudi relationship.
Turning to you, Hussein Ibish, how important in this current geopolitical context is Saudi Arabia to the United States? And do you believe also that, as Ellen said, that President Biden may have gone a bit too far with regard to the human rights emphasis, and now they're trying to recalibrate back to realpolitik?
Yeah, there's always a tension between politics and policy, and his rhetoric was very good politics for getting elected and especially winning the Democratic primary. But once in power, he's confronted with the fact that the 80-year-old U.S.-Saudi partnership is not altruistic. It's a marriage of convenience, and neither side has a good alternative to the other. So it has persevered through thick and thin with major shocks. And that's very likely to continue because the U.S. doesn't have an alternative partner in the Gulf region, and the Gulf remains absolutely critical. Even if you were to focus on great power competition with China, that's one of the biggest points of leverage over China is U.S. dominance in the Gulf and the three choke points, the Suez Canal, Bab el-Mandab in the Red Sea, and the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. So you ended up with this situation where he's had to climb back, and they're going to continue to do that. So he spoke about consequences. Well, the consequences are negligible. He spoke about revisiting. There isn't going to be any revisiting in my mind because in the end, U.S. interests are what they were, and that's what's going to happen. Now, I do think that we dodged a bullet for the short-term U.S.-Saudi relations in the midterm election, because if the Democrats had gotten a shellacking and lost the Senate, the blame game would have started and the Saudis would have been pretty high on the list after the OPEC plus oil price hike, basically. And now we have two other moments. There's the December 5th OPEC meeting. That's the same day that seaborne oil imports get boycotted by Europe from Russia. So it'd be a great opportunity for the Saudis, if it's the right moment, if Washington encourages them to do something to ease the pressure on the Europeans, they'd be well advised to coordinate with Washington and make sure there are no surprises and make sure that they help where they can, and it would be a very helpful thing. The last is the upcoming visit we all anticipate of party chairman Xi Jinping of China to Riyadh. And there you've got two problems. The optics, which he's going to be greeted with pomp and ceremony like Trump and Putin, but unlike Biden in Jeddah in July, he didn't want pomp and ceremony, but it's still something that anti-Saudi forces could point to as abusive of the United States. And then you've got the deliverables where there will be more engagement between China and Saudi Arabia. And that's something that Washington could take exception to if it looks like giving China a strategic foothold in signals intel or in anything dual use military in the Gulf region. I would be very sensitive to that. And the nuclear issue, which the two keep talking about collaborating on, which is a sensitive one. So if we can get past those two little hurdles, like we got through the midterms, I think we're good shape to get the U.S.-Saudi relationship back on track, which is really in the interests of both parties.
Well, we'll look for those two hurdles in the next couple of weeks. Hussein Ibish, thank you. Now moving on to the politics of the World Cup in neighboring Qatar, Ellen Lapson. In terms of the migrant labor abuse, of course, a lot of people point to really FIFA and its corruption in terms of even, you know, awarding the tournament to Qatar. But at any rate, as you know, there have been a lot of complaints about unpaid wages, dire living conditions, dangerous construction sites, and now even criticism about anti-gay sentiment. You know, it is a conservative Gulf state. But talk about some of those criticisms. But also, again, we have realpolitik. The United States and Qatar have an important relationship. We have the Al Udeid Air Base there. What are your thoughts with regard to U.S.-Qatar relations and some of the criticism they've come under for the World Cup?
Well, I think that some of the issues in U.S.-Qatar relations pale by comparison to the scale of the issues with Saudi Arabia. So I'm not worried about U.S.-Qatar defense and security cooperation. I think that will continue. What we are seeing, though, is that You know, here's Qatar, not unlike the United Arab Emirates, able to punch above its weight in part because of its wealth. So it can be a player in some of these global activities like the World Cup, in part because money talks in that early phase of the competition. But money didn't guarantee them a peaceful, perfect, you know, opening of the games, because certainly some of the global media and the fans themselves are reporting on some of these disconnects. The technology didn't work to let people into the stadium. At the very last minute, they imposed restrictions on where you could get beer, etc. So there are these clumsy interactions about how this global community of fans and sports interacts with a, as you said, socially conservative country in the Middle East. But I really think it's small potatoes in terms of grand strategy. And I think we should hope that eventually people will focus on the sporting part of it. It is exceedingly amusing for those of us who follow Gulf politics that the Saudis won their game and the Qataris didn't, you know. So here we have on the one hand a symbol that the former blockade of Qatar by the other GCC members is truly over. The Saudis sent a delegation. I believe MBS was at the opening of the games, but that the Saudis have this triumphant moment of a totally unexpected victory over Argentina. So the games raise some serious issues, as you said, about FIFA and how they make their selection process, but I don't think they're going to impact U.S.-Qatar relations in the long run.
Hussein Ibish.
Well, Mohammed bin Salman not only went to the opening game, which was a Qatar game, he wore the Qatar scarf. He went and supported Qatar, and he cheered for Qatar. And really, the extent to which the rapprochement between the GCC countries after the end of the boycott has been really much more thorough than most people had expected. Bahrain is a holdout, but it's not a big deal. UAE, Qatar, much friendlier than before. And as I said, Mohammed bin Salman showed up as a Qatar fan. Now, the Qataris lost their game. They didn't expect to win it. And they're enjoying hosting the tournament, which for them is going pretty well. And, you know, what you ended up with is on Tuesday, the 22nd, the best day ever for Arab football, which made everyone proud. Qatar is hosting the World Cup. Great. Saudi Arabia beat Argentina and Lionel Messi. Argentina hadn't lost for more than 30 games. They are one of the biggest powerhouses, arguably the biggest, and they lost. And everyone agreed Saudi Arabia was the better team on the day. It was a magnificent victory. And I think the Qataris were delighted. All the Arabs were delighted, all of them. And then Tunisia held Denmark to a draw. So this was a fantastic day for Arab soccer. And I think the fact that Qatar is hosting the World Cup with Saudi approval and smiles and hugs, and that then the Saudis made everyone proud by beating Lionel Messi's Argentina, of all countries, you know, sort of does a lot for Arab reconciliation. I think if you want a moment where the GCC reconciliation and goodwill between Arab countries was solidified, it was, of all things, in this day of great Arab soccer successes, above all, the Saudi victory over Argentina, which was a deserved victory. It wasn't a fluke. It wasn't luck. It wasn't anything like that. They were the better team on the day. And that's really important. So I think it was very remarkable, and it's going to have major political ramifications and reverberations. Silly as some people may think that is, this is how sport operates in the political and diplomatic landscape. It's potent.
Indeed, it is sport diplomacy. You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Hussein Ibish, from whom you just heard. He is senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. From Saudi Arabia to the World Cup and from Iran to Israel, this is a roundup of some of the top stories in the Middle East. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a Facebook fan, Reza Zolgadar from the city of Kashan in Isfahan, Iran. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, speaking of Iran, we are turning to Iran. So back to you, Ellen Leibson. The regime is cracking down violently on this uprising. Some call it almost a revolution. The protests morphed into a nationwide repudiation of the Islamic regime. And it seems like the revival of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, is now on the back burner. And now, of course, we see the mullahs, because they're seeing that these protests are not dying down. They're blaming the West for inciting the uprising, typical, of course, of autocratic regimes. How concerned are you about this development? And what more should we do that is in the West, in your view, to support the uprising?
Well, I think what we've learned over the years is that when it's an authentic bottom-up initiative by citizens of a country who really can no longer tolerate the conditions in which they live, the West has to be very careful to not look like it is intervening too much, because, as you said, regimes will immediately jump to the conclusion, whether it's for rhetorical purposes or whether they actually believe it, that somehow the West caused this whole event. So it's terribly important, if political change could occur through this process, that it be seen as authentic and legitimate in that society. So I think the U.S. has been very careful. On the one hand, it's inspiring and impressive to see how courageous young people, particularly young women, have been during these protests. And they have gone on for longer than many people believed. And this is not just an urban downtown Tehran phenomenon, but it's appearing in the remoter parts of Iran and virtually all major cities. So on the one hand, we admire them, but we have to be very careful on what is appropriate to do on their behalf. Mostly what I believe the Western governments have done is to try to keep communication space open. So allow them, through Elon Musk using one of his satellites and various means, to allow them to still have access to, you know, social media, even when the regime has tried to crack down. But I think there's a deep sense of worry and concern that these authoritarian regimes retain a lot of coercive power, and they seem to be quite insensitive to the suffering, you know, whether there are further consequences to using such brute force against unarmed civilian protesters. So what we are seeing is that the regime isn't fazed yet and believes that over time they will either totally intimidate people or that there will just be exhaustion on the part of the dissenters. So the people who follow Iran very closely think it's too early to say how this is likely to play out. The regime still has a chance to prevail over these young protesters, but it is yet again, at least once a decade, uprisings against the Islamic Republic that we've seen in the 40 years they've been in power.
Hussein Ibish, what's your take? Is it too early to see how this is going to play out? Will this uprising fizzle out at some point from exhaustion and the repression? Where do you see it going?
Well, I agree with Professor Leibson. Everything she said was true. And it is too early to tell, because where we are now is at a stalemate. This is one of the most potent and long-lasting of the uprisings. It's not one of the biggest, though, or the most disruptive. It has roped in a lot of performers and artists and sports people. The Iranian team declined to sing the national anthem at their first game in the World Cup. That was something. But then they did meet before with President Raisi, who's a hardliner. But anyway, it's got a big cultural heft to it, but it's a stalemate. The protests aren't ending. The government doesn't know how to end them. And there's only so much brutality you can do. The army, for example, I think in any country is very likely to open fire on ordinary people. Security forces will do that. In Iran, the Basij and the IRGC might do it, but the army isn't going to. That's what happened in Egypt. The security forces were overwhelmed by the protesters, and the military just declined to open fire on the general public because it's their own families, ultimately. But the protesters have no way of forcing the government to concede anything on the issue of head covering, which is what this is about. What the demand is, insofar as there is a single one, is let us choose whether to cover our hair or not. Give us choice. And the regime's answer is no. The regime doesn't want to begin reform, because if you can reform on head covering, why can't you reform on other things? And there is no logical answer to that. So obviously they don't want to give in to popular change in what they review as a lawless manner. Now, here's the thing. The stalemate can't be broken because the regime can't get the people back off the streets. They're hoping for exhaustion, but it hasn't set in. And the protesters don't have a solution. So the big problem is that you've got two kinds of protests in the world and in Iran. You've got protests over bread and protests over freedom. And we've seen both kinds. We've seen working class demonstrators take to the street over jobs and money and bread and water also was another big one. And the middle class and the urban classes basically did not generally come out in support of them. And now we've got a protest over what amount to a freedom protest, not a bread protest. And it's mainly on cultural grounds, not on class grounds. And the working class has not come out, generally speaking, in support of these women-led culture-based demonstrators. If you can combine a working class bread demonstration with a cultural, basically middle class freedom uprising, then you've got the regime boxed in and you've got a real problem. As long as they can keep the working class separate from the cultural dissidents and a women-led movement and whatnot, then I think there is a good chance the regime can weather the storm again. But the moment the bread protesters combine with the freedom protesters, then the regime is in big, big trouble.
Alan Lapson, what about Tehran's increasing military cooperation with Russia in violation of the UN, sending drones and missiles to the Kremlin, which are used, of course, against innocent civilians in Ukraine? Is there anything the West or the UN, the Western alliance, can do to hold Iran and Russia accountable?
Well, I think we're seeing defiance on Iran's part in other ways. The IAEA, the Atomic Energy Agency, expressed their deep concern that Iran is also upgrading its enrichment activities at Fordo, and their IAEA is going to demand additional inspections. So we're seeing the Iranians play to their camp in more than one way. The almost certain demise of the JCPOA is staring us in the face. The cooperation with Russia, it's a sign of Russia's weakness to some extent, but it's a pre-existing alliance of convenience that started over Syria, and they're not natural partners, they're not true allies, but this is a military supply relationship, and it speaks to Russia's shortages. I'm not sure that it will make a significant difference on the battlefield. The Iranians do have some sophisticated technology that is produced domestically, but I think the macro picture of the Ukraine war is not going to be determined by Iran's partial engagement in this process.
Let's move on to Israel. So, Ellen Lapson, do you think that a right-wing government is inevitable in Israel now? You know, there's a debate about the makeup and direction of the government in light of Bibi's victory and his right-wing extremist allies clamoring for cabinet positions. Some are saying, you know, this is a turning point in Israel, that its image and policy implications for the future of the state, you know, are really on the line when you have the likes of an Itamar Ben-Gvir, an extreme politician. How do you see this moment in Israeli politics?
Well, I think that interim between Bibi's past control of the government and what is almost certain to happen now, that interregnum was a kind of strange moment of somewhat greater moderation, but still that balancing act of the different factions of Israeli politics. And Israeli domestic politics have moved steadily to the right. There's no doubt about it. Bibi is a tactician as well. You know, he has a strategic vision for Israel, but I think in the short run, he is willing to do business with these folks. So we're already seeing in Jerusalem an uptick in violence with Palestinians. I think we're in for a very dark period in Israel-Palestinian relations, and it's going to pose some serious issues for the Biden administration of how to manage the relationship with Israel.
You get the last word, Hussein Ibish. It's a very precarious moment.
Honestly, from the biggest picture, ever since the failure of the Camp David summit way back in the summer of 2000, the most likely scenario always was that Israel would try to ultimately impose by force what it could not get the Palestinians to agree to at the negotiating table. I think that's just the way human beings are. And that's certainly the case between Israel and the Palestinians. So I think this election and what it bespeaks about the direction of Israeli society and politics to the extreme right, not only annexationist, but expulsionist right, is that we're one step closer to the day when, probably under the cover of some major violence in the occupied territories, that a very right-wing Israeli government imposes a new border on whatever line suits them at the moment and accompanies that with a significant amount of expulsions. We saw them in 1947-48, again in 1967. There's absolutely no reason under the current chaotic global circumstances with the international international order so precarious that the Israelis couldn't get away with it. And I think that, unfortunately, given how human nature is and given the ambitions of a growing bloc of Israelis who simply are determined to keep hold of big chunks of the West Bank, will not agree to incorporate the Palestinians who live in those parts of the West Bank, that annexation and expulsion is not only the logical outcome, but also is closer than ever.
That is indeed rather pessimistic. So I'll end on a note by an editorial writer in Israel. He says that maybe Israeli society needs to experience a deep crisis of values, a deep social and diplomatic crisis in order to change course. But on that note, that is just about all the time we have on this Middle East edition of Encounter. I would like to thank my terrific guests, Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Hussein Ibish. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.